Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Glenn and Helen Show. This week, our guest is Werner Vinge. He's a famed computer scientist, mathematician, futurist, and science fiction writer. His new book, Rainbow's End, comes out next week.
We'll talk about the singularity, the future of the internet, whether college will be obsolete, and more. And I ask about computer-simulated sex, which I'm still not sure about.
We've got Werner Vinge on the line. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Glenn.
Hi, Dr. Vinge. How are you doing?
Good.
Good. Okay, my first question is, whenever your name comes up, so does the concept of the singularity. Can you explain that for our listeners?
Well, the notion is looking at the hardware progress and communication progress, if one looks at that and assumes that the trends were to continue, then comparing that with the hardware power that we see in living systems, in particular people, it seems that in the next few decades, we would reach a point where, in terms of raw hardware power, there would be parity. And there's a big jump, of course, between the notion of having a hardware power parity and having a psychological or creative equivalence. But at least there is a potential there that was a little bit harder to imagine when a person was talking about machines that were far less capable hardware than humans. I don't know whether most people in the old days at least really realized how good we are as computational devices, far ahead of anything that exists. But if we did reach that sort of parity, then the question is what would happen? And I think the age-old question, will there ever be a machine as smart as a person, is not really quite the relevant one. The relevant thing is what happens after that. And what happens after that would be a type of technical progress that would be different than in the past in a qualitative way, because if you had something that had greater creativity than a human, it would be a situation where we are no longer at the inventive center. And the analogy that I like to use is that if you had a time machine and could bring Mark Twain into our present, you could explain the situation to him very easily, and he'd understand it. And in the course of a day, I think he would be up to speed, and I think he would enjoy it very much. But if you tried to do the same exercise with a goldfish, you would be doomed to failure. So in that sense, what comes after that point of crossover is not knowable. It's a different sort of futurology than in the past, when people would say predict the impacts of cell phones or jet planes. Their predictions were often wrong, but at least they were talking about something where what did happen would be explainable. Mm-hmm. You could understand it if someone were to tell you about it. And there's a difference in this situation when you go past this point where you can't understand. We could not understand what is going on there, even if somebody wanted to explain it to us. So I think calling it technological singularity is very appropriate, and that's half of the reason, the sort of unknowability by analogy with singularities in physics. And the other half is just that it is a very big change, and singularities are typically in math and physics used to describe situations where you have to have a whole new set of rules to describe what's going on. For instance, a supersonic shock wave is actually a type of spatial singularity.
I think what I find interesting is just the psychological aspect of that. Like, for example, I read where you said that this singularity marks the passing of man from center stage. What did you mean by that?
Well, the thing that actually has made us be the dominant player is the fact that we are creative and we are intelligent. And as far as we know, we're the the most intelligent critters running around on the Earth. And that's the thing we usually point to when we point to our preeminence here on Earth. And so losing that preeminence, I think, fits very well with the metaphor of leaving center stage.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it interests me. I think that a lot of people tend to focus on intelligence as sort of a surrogate for power. And one of the things that I notice looking around the world is that the smartest people are not the people in charge, and the people in charge are definitely not the smartest people.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder, you know, I always like to refer to James Branch Cabell's book, Jurgen, where Jurgen meets the person who really runs the universe. He's actually God's boss, Kaschi the Deathless. And Kaschi's not that smart. He's really powerful, but he's just not that bright. And Jurgen, who's always prided himself on his cleverness, has this horrible moment where he realizes that cleverness is not on top and never has been. And I wonder, you know, people who talk about AI and the singularity are usually people who are pretty smart themselves. I think like Jurgen, they kind of pride themselves on their cleverness. But what if cleverness isn't on top? What if, in fact, we have superhuman AI, incredibly smart, and it just turns out not to matter that much? Do you think that's likely?
Actually, I think that the general notion of intelligence is broad enough and ill-defined enough that I think I would dispute the start of your statement. In other words, general intellectual capability is a broad and many splendored thing, and it certainly goes beyond what the geeks of us, you know, pride ourselves in terms of intelligence. It is true that in the short run, I mean, if you're up against somebody with a handgun supplied by several centuries of very bright people, but if you're up against a person with a handgun and he doesn't have to be very smart to you know, make the end of that story. On the other hand, in any sort of protracted situation, if you let the smart people, you know, the clever and capable people hang around, things will probably change.
Yeah, your Medicis and Borgias were pretty smart.
Yeah.
You know, in your story, True Names, you often get credit for having sort of predicted the shape of the modern internet. How do you compare the internet of 2025 in your book, your new book, Rainbow's End, with the internet we see today? What's the biggest difference there in a story that's almost sort of a pre-singularity or a cusp of the singularity kind of world?
Right. Yeah. Rainbow's End. That's the 2025 you're referring to. Here,
yes.
Right. Probably something that's happening during the singularity. The people that are participating in it are kind of in the middle of it all and don't. Aren't in a position to quite appreciate that, but that's likely what is happening. And the biggest differences between the 2025 era and our 2006 era, I think, are in two things. One is that people talk a lot about ubiquitous computing. Ubiquitous computing is a relative term, and we have ubiquitous computing compared to 1960. In this 2025 era, I have ubiquitous computing that is substantially beyond what we have. It's getting into the general era, general area of where the physical world wakes up. It's getting close to that. The other substantial difference is that the ability of people to coordinate with their networks and with each other has attained a kind of seamlessness and a power that is magical by the standards that we have now. Although I hope that people reading it can kind of see how it grows out of what we have now. For instance, right now, if you're on the phone talking to somebody and have your hands free and an odd term comes up, or a question about movies comes up, you can look awfully smart if you're willing to put up with a few seconds delay. when you have even better user interfaces, wearable computers, and very high degree of ubiquity, then it becomes to the point where it's hard to tell when you're talking to somebody exactly what is going on or exactly how much that they do know. And there are places in this story where there are individuals that are behaving with melodramatically superhuman abilities. But if you just look at it, on one hand, it looks like unrealistic melodrama, as you'd expect, say, from a movie or modern light adventure. But on the other hand, it's something that we are getting close to being able to support, where, say, an individual operating in the field is actually the pointy end of an immense hierarchy of people, but also people who are hooked up into databases and into dynamic databases, which exist in this story much more than they do now.
It's like the Verizon commercial brought to life for real.
Remind me, I've seen some very good commercials along that line. I'm not tagging that one.
That's the one where the guy is followed around by 1,000 people or so who are his network at all times, you know, answering his questions and stuff. Yeah, it is. One of the things that struck me, in fact, I read an advanced copy of Rainbow's End, and of course, I wrote this nonfiction book, An Army of Davids, which kind of talks about technology empowering people and horizontal knowledge that lets people coordinate and such. And then I read your book and I was like, holy crap, this is my world. It's described a lot more excitingly in your book. But
I like writing fiction because I can, you know, I'm not so constrained. Many wonderful things about An Army of Davids, but, you know, one is that you're talking about things, there are speculative things in there, but you're talking about things that are there right now. And great things that are there right now. And it would take real disasters to take those away. And on the other hand, one of the great things about this whole trend is that it makes us more confident in our ability to deal with the onset of emergencies. That things like the Army of Davids gives us the potential for keeping up with threat levels that in some ways are greater than they ever were before, and in other cases are just more understood than they ever were before.
Yeah, you actually give a great example of that in your book. In fact, in Rainbow's End, we have sort of the upside and the downside, right? You've got public health hobbyists discovering new plagues before the government does. But of course, on the other hand, the downside is the plagues are basically the product of one guy who's trying to take over the world.
Right.
Are you sort of an optimist or a pessimist about how all this stuff is going to work out?
I would certainly like to be an optimist. I see many, many very serious threats kind of at all time scales and size scales. Martin Rees has this book called Our Final Hour, in which he argues that, you know, getting out of the 21st century alive for the human race is a long shot. And actually, I think we are in very risky times. And one thing that's absolutely true, I think, is that enormous disasters are possible, even if the overall story has a happy ending. You know, you look at the 20th century, and a person can remark how, isn't it nice, you know, at the end of the 20th century, how much better things were than at the beginning, and how many great disasters had been avoided. Well, on the other hand, there's a number of people you could have talked to in the 20th century who would have debated that rosy vision of reality. And so I think that probably the overall trends are enormously positive, and that it does not mean that terrible things can happen along the way. And I guess that is life. And one nice thing about it is that the Pollyanna-ish sorts of things about imagining things beyond your horizon that eventually do get better, that's almost certainly true.
Well, one of the things that's really gotten better for me is just the what they can do with heart health now. For example, I've got a implantable defibrillator, but I think that's really amazing. But I look at your idea, or the idea of mind transfer, having your mind copied onto a computer, and that's really confusing to me. Could you kind of explain that a little bit to our listeners, what the idea of mind transfer is?
Right. I have written myself, my science fiction has had very little of that. Probably the best one was a story called The Cookie Monster. Mm-hmm. The general notion is of uploading, that if a person does, but this is a general consequence of what happens when we do get do think in a reductionist sort of a way. You eventually get into a situation where you look at what the hardware power of the brain is, and you look at what describing the state of the brain is, and then you talk about, well, what would happen if you could just save that someplace, and then run it at a later time, or run multiple copies of it, run it in a rebuilt human body, or run it on a good simulator. Is that still a person? Is it? And if it is it the same person? And it's really remarkable to me that questions like that, when they come up, they bring us face to face with very hard and very old questions. But I think arguably, it's something new under the sun, because in the past, people could argue about things like that, and there wasn't even any way of phrasing the questions in such a pointed way as we can now.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have now is some possibility of talking about things that really, really makes a person question what things like self-awareness and point of view are really like. In fact, I think perhaps that if a person looked at issues of self-awareness, identity, if you look at it closely enough, in one sense, I think, therefore, I am has been advertised as the one thing we can be sure of.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at it closely enough, it's a little bit like a ground fog, and the closer you get to it, the harder it is to see it.
Well, I mean, self-awareness is nice and all, but, like, how would you have sex in a computer? That's the first thing I said to
actually,
Glenn when he told me about a mind transfer.
Stories, but if you look at the Ship Who Sang by Anne McCaffrey, and there are a number of science fiction writers who have written very, very neat stories where they start out essentially the question that you just raised.
Uh-huh.
And by the end of it, they've succeeded in convincing at least a significant a percentage of the readership that actually the creature coming out the other out of the process looks back and has similar pitiable comments to make about what he was like before.
Oh.
It's a little bit like, you know, us sort of imagining trying to explain to a zygote or something why what we're up to in our later lives.
Yeah, that's well, of course, that's Ray Kurzweil in The Age of Spiritual Machines, kind of actually shows one character through that evolution over the course of the 21st century. And I just finished reading John Barnes' new book, where he makes clear that if there's mind uploading going on, you want to be the copy. You don't want to be the original, because the original dies. You know, it's still stuck in the body. The copy gets to go off and be reinstalled repeatedly.
I think, you know, most people in their lives imagine these things they wish they had done, even if they don't regret the decisions they have made. And to me, the great potential is becoming something that is better and better and better than you were before. But there is sort of a horizontal version, and that is that you just get to do all the things you ever thought about doing as well as you can. And David Brin wrote a great book that really explores this sort of horizontal cross-section extraordinarily well, and that's Killing People.
Oh, yeah, I loved that. It's funny, you know, you really do get to sort of, by reading these things, explore the human condition. But, you know, it could be real. I mean, I should point out to Helen that in True Names, you explored the phenomenon of internet addiction, and she's already an internet addict. So,
yeah.
On the singularity front, do you think the state of the world matters as we enter the singularity? I mean, if we have a peaceful, prosperous world on the front end, are we more likely to come out on the other side in a good condition? or is it so unpredictable that it's just impossible to say?
Actually, I think it is more unpredictable than most things. My intuition is that going into it peacefully and in a prosperous state makes it much more likely that it would work out very well. Certainly, wartime developments of something like this, it seems, would be very plausibly rather nasty critters. And there's also a question of how fast it happens. I like to say that, you know, you can't speculate, you can't really say anything beyond the singularity. That's why I call it the singularity. But it's fun to speculate. And there are some analogies. For instance, I think the most significant analogy is just the rise of the human race within the animal kingdom, is what this transition looks like. But there are other analogies. And one thing about most of these analogies, though, is that the change resulted in events going on much more quickly. For instance, the rise of the humans meant that once those guys showed up on the scene, even if they didn't have technology as we do now, they could cause changes much, much faster than the animals were used to. And so that makes it plausible to me that actually once the singularity happened, we might see technical changes, overt changes in the world, happen much faster. And it's even possible that the transition itself would happen very fast. So I distinguish between what I call a hard takeoff and a soft takeoff. These are both ways of scenarios involving the singularity. A soft takeoff is one that takes decades between the time that people begin to recognize that it really is happening and the time that, you know, everybody agrees that it has happened. And actually, most people, when they talk about the singularity, I think they're thinking of a soft takeoff. That's what my reading of Ray's stuff is.
Yeah, I think that's right.
I think that actually would be the most, that would mean that we would have a lot of input. You know, as you go along, you could make changes and you could sort of negotiate among yourselves and with the things that you're beginning to make. But the contrast that to a hard takeoff, which I think is plausible by analogy with say the last time something like this happened. A hard takeoff might be 100 hours from the time that people are still having conversations like this to the point where unequivocally the universe has totally changed and it's being, you know, run by people that are very, you know, beyond our intellectual horizon. If it takes 100 hours, that transition were to take 100 hours, I call that a hard takeoff by analogy with the notion of a hard crash.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is so creative and so massively changing that it actually resembles an explosion more than anything else, a physical explosion. And that's the type that it might be quite benign, but it's totally beyond our ability to do much with in terms of guiding it.
Well, in that case, I guess the only reason to talk about it now is just because talking about it now is fun.
And actually, I brought this up in one situation, and someone was saying that, well, yeah, on the other hand, it might be good to be working on these human, you know, human interfaces with these systems, so that even if it happened very fast, it might be that there would be actually people thinking about it and talking about it would be keeping up, even though they would be operating much, you know, even though they'd be operating at a much faster rate than unaugmented people such as you and I would be operating at.
Plus, there's also the Kent Brockman angle to that. You know, maybe you could make it as a collaborator. I, for one, welcome our new AI overlords. Well, you know, one of the things that struck me in Rainbow's End was you have these high school students, and they're not even the especially talented ones, And yet, as for their class projects, they're producing art that, you know, you say would have seemed shockingly good in the 1990s, thanks to the technological edge. And that seemed really plausible to me, because I see that kind of thing happening now. I mean, you know, I produce techno at home on a computer, and compared to what you did not long ago with a hardware sequencer or a hardware sampler, what you can do on the computer is just light years ahead. And the stuff is better, and you do it faster. And I see that across a huge range of things. And that just seems to be a really powerful trend that it almost leads to a kind of singularity of its own, whether we ever get to a strong AI or not.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that that without the sort of extreme unknowability of what I would call the technological singularity, we are seeing changes here that are it seems to me, beyond debate. They're on the order of the invention of the printing press and, you know, the invention of agriculture, things like that. The critical change, I think, would be, the more extreme version would be, if you really can't understand what's going on and you're really dealing with you know, critters that are over our horizon in the same way that we're over the horizon of a chimpanzee. But what is actually going on is clearly a change of at least the magnitude of the Industrial Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah. And also, I think the notion that we may be able to keep up just because the resource that the fundamental resource is having not just lots of people, but lots of creative people who are well-educated and reasonably well-off, and they can communicate. And they have the databases to support that. That means that you have millions of people out there that are as smart and as knowledgeable as the people who have kind of been the people running society in the past. And at that point, when you think about, say, having in the world right now, there are probably 10,000 Winston Churchill category people, and in the past, most of them, you know, died young, stayed down on the farm, and they never got to talk to anybody. And now when you have large groups of people with all sorts of different skill sets, it seems to me that it may be possible to, it's very likely that those people will have a sense of self-interest that is extraordinarily broad. And sometimes I hope that, for instance, some of these very large countries that appear to be going in directions that are extremely dangerous, but that actually it may be that their people will just prevent that from happening in a way that they couldn't in the past. In the past, if you wanted to prevent things from happening, you had a bloody revolution, and things were much worse afterwards. And now, I think it's a situation that maybe someday people will wake up and just find that the world has moved over to adult supervision, and that just basically means everybody.
Boy, I hope so. I mean, I hope that when it comes to sort of intelligent, creative people, you know, we're going to find that quantity has a quality all its own.
Right. And it's, and you know, in the past, this was, I think a person could argue against this in the past, that all you got were bigger mobs. And I think there's a real probability that that's not the case if they are communicating and have the databases. In fact, in the 93, singularity paper, I think I had like four or five paths to the singularity, and it strikes me that the ensemble of people and their computers talking, that actually was one of the items on the list, and it certainly appears to be the path toward the singularity that we're, you know, shooting down the fastest. When a person just talks about Moore's law, and the way I introduced, you know, when I first answered Helen's question, that sort of puts in a person's mind that you're talking about certain one way that it's going to happen, namely AIs as we have conceived them in the past. And frankly, I think that really is a possibility. But the other possibility that also uses all of this hardware is the notion of ubiquitous computing, and that you eventually get an ensemble behavior that is superhuman. And then there's this book that Gregory Stock, I think, wrote in the early 80s called Metaman, nonfiction. And where he goes into that in some detail. And it certainly appears to be the path that we're heading down. And really, in Rainbow's End, that is well along that path.
Well, that's one thing I really liked about that book was that it was, I thought it was a very plausible view of the future, but also a fairly optimistic one, even though you do point out that it's kind of a Red Queen's race with extinction, where we have to keep trying to get ahead of the threats before they kill us.
Where do you think college comes in as you're talking, and as I'm listening to you all talking, I'm sort of thinking, you know, do you think college at some point will become obsolete?
I skirted around that in the story, since mm-hmm. much of the story takes place, you know, at a university. I think that that actually the notion of, you know, licensed expertise could well weaken, but the notion that a lot of effort is needed to learn something that involves contemplation as well as being plugged in everywhere, that will stay. And so something like colleges and universities stays, although I think it's quite possible that we've been living with the hype about remote teaching for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that that we may be entering an era where something like that eventually comes to pass. Similarly with laboratories, that a lot of laboratories can be, for the most part, be used remotely the way observatories are nowadays.
So people could learn on their own, say, wherever they are.
Physically, they're on their own.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of mentally and working with other people, there would be a lot of the contemplation and at the same time apprenticeship that there has been in the past. I think one thing that makes it look a lot different is that when I say contemplation, it implies sort of being away from things, and that's true. But at the same time, if a person's learning math, they want to learn and contemplate and all of that, but they also want to learn to be totally plugged into all the symbolic and numerical packages that can lend horsepower to contemplation.
That makes a lot of sense. Of course, as a professor myself, I have a real vested interest in the notion of higher education not being obsolete. I guess you're retired now, right? So you don't care. It's all... How is that? You know, you of course, are a mathematician, as Helen's father was, actually, and taught computer science, and now you've retired to write full-time. And how has that worked out for you?
It's worked out very well. By the way, as with you, I enjoyed the teaching enormously. I think if you're in an area that you like, that it's just about the best job that mm-hmm. a person can have. And so I certainly expect and wish the best for it. In my situation, I started teaching at San Diego State in 1972, and I retired in 2000. So, you know, I really had a full career there, and this has worked out very well. They've treated me very well, and I really, you know, I go over to school often, and actually I'm on, this will interest you, I'm still on a committee. It's really fun to be on a committee when you're sort of, you know, when it's not quite, you know, when you're not quite as closely involved as you are, you know, at the same time that you're doing all the teaching.
Yeah, I can see that. Although I think the one thing that's sure to survive the singularity are faculty committees. I think they move in geological time, and apparently nothing can speed them up or put an end to them.
Right.
Well, you know, one of the things that's interesting about your writing is you craft a lot of really deep and interesting and sort of engaging characters with a lot of different kinds of personalities. And, you know, where do you get the models for that? I don't guess you saw most of them around the computer science department. Maybe I'm wrong.
I think it's It is basically all the people you see and mixing and matching, and then historical figures, and oftentimes you'll see things in the news and stuff, and there are aspects of them that are intriguing, and you can intensify them, especially if you combine them with other things that you know about. In this particular story, I was very careful because, the story involves academics. Involves academics in a place that I have been, and it's talking about an era that I was involved in, and it's very important that there not be hidden slams and stuff like that. And I was very careful on that, and I am now waiting for people to tell me, oh, such and such is obviously related to this in the real world, but it wasn't.
Now I know who that was supposed to be, right? Yeah, well, that's the advantage of writing about intelligent spiders 30,000 years in the future or something.
Actually,
I guess.
Actually, I got bitten the worst on that.
Oh.
I got one letter from a person who said, I had a red-haired character who looked like a villain through most of the story. He says, oh, I enjoyed this novel very much. And I also saw the tip of the hat that you rendered to so-and-so, my friend so-and-so, because she looks like this, she talks like this, she's smart this way, and I was pleased she turned out not to be the villain. So this was a total surprise to me. But looking back on it, I went and looked back at the story, and I looked at the real person that he was talking about, and it was just awesome. And it's actually sort of scary, the notion that you can be sitting there writing, minding your own business, and creating something that is such an awesome coincidence.
Any resemblance to persons living or dead is entirely coincidental.
Right.
Well, I noticed when we called you, you were screening your calls on your answering machine. Do you hear from a lot of fans?
No. This is just general paranoia.
What's it like to be a futurist hero in general?
The whole thing about writing science fiction has been very, very great pleasure. For one thing, science fiction gets read by such interesting people. And over the years, I've run into a number of people that I probably would never have had any chance to talk to otherwise. And this actually has been I've been able to pick brains far more intelligent than mine. In fact, I have this theory about science fiction. Well, actually, writing in general, and that is that. It is possible to write in such a way that you brain parasitize the reader. In other words, you can impress readers who are smarter than you are. And the trick is to enlist their intelligence in the issue. In other words, if you regard their minds as sort of a display device, that if you can figure out how to write something so that it can be displayed on this IQ 200 mind, then those people are going to really think the story is great. And what they're really doing is that they've used their own intelligence to figure out why it is so good. And the key to doing this, of course, is right at the beginning to really get the reader on your side. Because if you turn it around and you lose the reader, and the reader is a smart reader, they can figure out reasons why every darn thing you said, no matter how innocent, is actually incorrect.
This sounds a lot like blogging.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it sure does.
Well, we're almost out of time, but let me ask you if you have any predictions or signposts along the way to the singularity.
Things to watch for. I think there are positive things. There are things, what I call them, pro-symptoms and con-symptoms, and that, pro-symptom means it raises, if you're betting on this, it raises the probability that it's going to happen. A con-symptom makes it go down. Con systems, of course, would be things like we notice more and more the large software projects go down in flames, and we get more and more large system failures where people try to coordinate across large networks. Pro-symptoms are things where we really start to see, we get up to the point where we have machines with millions of processors in them. Actually, we're very close to that right now. I mean, in essentially one box. And people start playing with those. And we begin to see discovering things that we couldn't see when we didn't have boxes that powerful to play with. This sort of thing happened in the mid-20th century with computers. Early 20th mm-hmm. century, there were guys who did a lot about numerical weather prediction with paper and pencil. And they devised schemes that if you had computers, you know, could solve the numerical weather prediction. When we finally got those computers, we discovered that there were things about the paper and pencil methods that actually would break after two or three steps. These guys never noticed it because they didn't have the time to go beyond two or three steps. What's amazing about that is even the abstract people, the mathematicians, didn't know about some of these issues. Now, in retrospect, they can explain them. We have whole new branches of mathematics that came up to explain those problems. And so if we get into a range of millions of processors, that sort of power, and people get into experiment with that, if that begins to produce results, for instance, one category of result is right now if you have more processor cores on your machine, well, you can do more separate processes. But if we begin to see solutions where a million processors allows you to handle problems that are not simply big array problems, but that are classical sort of processing problems that we used to think, you know, had to be within the purview of one execution thread, that would be I think that would be strong evidence that we're that a strong pro symptom. Other pro symptoms is if we simply start noticing that answers and even anonymous answers begin to become very easy things to get on the net. Right now, if you have a laptop that's not working right, you can usually find out things about it without using the manufacturer, you know, just sort of fooling around both with non-human data sources and with human news groups. Mm-hmm. This intensifies to the point where you walk along and you have problems and the problems just sort of get solved. There's sort of that may sound magical, but we're actually on sort of a slide into that. And Bruce Sterling wrote a remarkable story that sort of illustrated what it could look like in Maneki Neko, where the singularity stuff is just sort of happening in the background, and the symptom is that things just start getting better and better.
Ah, so if our computers quit crashing, we know something's terribly wrong.
Right. Or from their standpoint, terribly right.
There you go. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. I thought this was really interesting, and I suspect a lot of people will too. And I'm sure one important signpost toward the singularity is for Rainbow's End to sell millions of copies.
That's right.
So let's make it so. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks very much for the chat.
Thanks very much.
Okay.
Well, that was interesting. I'm still not sure about the computer sex, though.
We'll try the beta when it comes out. I do think it's interesting to hear his views because he's got such a good track record so far. And I hope that things turn out as well as he and I think they will. We hope you think that this podcast turned out well, too. We'll be back with another episode whenever we feel like it. You can check for updates at our websites, instapundit.com or drhelen.blogspot.com, or you can subscribe via iTunes. We like that. Stay tuned, and until we're back, have fun on the internet.
Talk to you next time. Come on, baby. Oh, I said, come on, baby. Now, come on, baby. Oh, I said, come on, baby.